One of the things that has really excited me over probably the past 20 years, maybe, is an emerging idea from within the church. It's not emerging, it's always been there, but the church tends to go through periods where it might focus on one thing, then focus on another thing, and there's always more to find out. But one of the things that's really, it's given me a huge amount of joy, is the way that we've started increasingly to think about the storyline of the Bible in a big way. We do very often dig deep into texts, but what we're looking to do is to get to a point where we understand what is the big picture that is being unfolded in front of us. And therefore, against that big picture, how do we place ourselves in the story and understand who we are today, and therefore how to respond to the way that God has revealed himself to us? In technical terms, you'd probably call it an emergence of biblical theology again. But I think we've just almost described it in one of the songs, which we could open with. The opening words were, "Do you feel the world is broken?" We do. Really, you could write that over this whole series. Do you feel the world is broken? We do. We know that, we feel that. And at the same time, we're trying to orientate ourselves and understand, well, if that's the case, what do we do with the message of the gospel? One of the ways I think the world is broken is in the sense of a desire to be together in some way. But at the same time, we're separated in so many ways. We're against each other, yet we desire to be with each other and for each other. Again, art and movies tend to explore this theme. Two movies that really speak into the idea. There was a film in 1993, 6 Degrees of Separation. It talks about the idea that every one of us is connected some way to everybody else in the world by a maximum of 6 links of relationship. That's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Everybody in the world is connected to you by a maximum of 6 relational connections. That's pretty amazing, I think. The whole world, there's lots of people in the world, but 6 degrees of separation. I'm not even going to kind of try to prove it. It's an interesting idea. But what I think that movie and what that idea is speaking into is there is a way in which we want a sense of oneness. And then named after our reading, after our text today, there's a film in 2006 called Babel. And that almost takes the theme of connectedness, but looks at it from a tragic perspective. The idea that we are interconnected, and yet tragedy connects us in bizarre and complex ways. We are surrounded, we are impacted, and we are affected every single day by the tragic brokenness of those events that go on around us. See, we want that connectedness, but the inverse reality is our experience. We know race separation, we know tribalism. We know one group against another. We experience it every day, one way or another. Either when we switch on the news, from the tragedy and the horror of the wars around the world that we see right now, the tribalism that displays in front of us, places in our minds every day, to the office fight over which brand of coffee we're going to buy. What are they? They are all experiences of factionism and tribalism and the desperate desire that we have to belong to one in opposition to the other. We don't really feel like, we don't decide, I'm going to join the Nescafe. If you join the Nescafe coffee club, speak to me afterwards. You really need some help with coffee. But I'm going to join the Nescafe coffee club. I love it. And it's all really positive until those cart door people come along and try to impose something different. And then my tribalism becomes something which is no longer just for, it's against as well. It's written into our DNA. It's written into our experience. It is who we are as people. And there is a comic jest around it. And there is a human tragedy around it. And yet, we cannot get away from it. Our art speaks about it. Our day-to-day experience reminds us of it. The news reflects that horror of our experience, and we ask, how have we got here? How is it that in spite of all human progress, we seem to be increasingly against each other rather than increasingly with each other? I do not know of any technological advancement in humanity that has not created a tribalism for and against in one way or another. It is who we are. It is how we are. And so I want to ask the question of the Bible today, how did we get here? Because the text that we have gives us an insight into the way Genesis, the early chapters of Genesis, describe the human condition. We find ourselves with all of the people of the world together on a building task. I am so glad that Ash did the first two because he gave me a really nice little framework, which is roots, fruits, and shoots. That's great. I'm carrying on the theme. What's the root of the issue? For those of you who know a little bit of about the Bible, I'm going to say this right at the beginning. It all starts in Babylon. It all starts in Babylon. And we're going to come back to that as we unfold. And we're going to see how that all starting in Babylon plays out across the whole of the storyline of the Bible and actually what is underneath that idea of it all starts in Babylon. Where's the root? The whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, if you remember your minds back to Genesis chapter 3, they go eastward away from God. That's the emblem of going eastward. And they found a plain in Shinar, which is Babylon. They find themselves in Babylon. They're not quite there. They didn't sort of walk through the arches of Babylon and it says, welcome to Babylon. It's just this great big piece of ground with nothing. The plain of Shinar. But they start to build. Let's make bricks and bake them. They used brick instead of stone and bitumen for mortar, and they said something critically important. Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. That little sentence is packed. It's packed with Bible ideas. What happened in Genesis chapter 1 and 2? God names his creation. And then he gives his creation the opportunity to name everything else. And now they want to make a name for themselves. And it's a name that they are creating for themselves. Together, they want to reach the heavens. Have you ever had that experience? When They would have had it all the time because they didn't have light pollution the way we have it. And they'd have gone out in the middle of the night and they'd have looked up and it would have been a mass of stars, bright stars, just so vivid. And they look up and they think there is something majestic about being up there. And we've got this little inkling of what we know of our heritage and our past. And we know that God's up there. At least that's how they would have thought. We want to be a name for ourselves outside of God. We want to create an identity. It wasn't me. They want to build a pinnacle to coalesce around. Do you know what? I find it really, really fascinating that this idea of building something really tall is just, it's just written into us, isn't it? Back in the 1920s, there was almost a competition in New York who could build the tallest skyscraper. And everybody tried to do what? To make a name for themselves. And now we do it across the nations. We always want to make something that we can coalesce around and say, look at us. Look at what we've done. Look at our identity. You know, when I'm not here, that tower's still going to be there and it's going to remind you of me because I want to be something. I want to be more. If I remember, Solomon's son built a tower to himself. He wanted to be remembered. Here we have the people, they're saying, let's build something. We want to create a state of autonomy and dominance over the created order. We want to be the dominant ones. We don't want that idea of God to be the dominant ones. We want to be the ones who are dominant. We want to rule. We want to be seen. And then what do? They start to create. Any of you know me, know that I am utterly fascinated with technology and the way technology has unfolded over the centuries. And the human idea of building things and making things can be a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it can also be the very foundation on which we say we do not need God anymore because we can make. Look at what they do. They make bricks. I think a side of the ark, I think this is the first statement of real technology. Not stones. Do you see the way they make the point? They didn't use stones, they made bricks. They're becoming creative. They're making something. We're going to make something here. We're going to build a city. We're going to build a tower. We're going to go up to the heavens. We're going to reach that God and we're going to say, I'm here. We are here. We've done this. What is at the core of the human issue? It's that. It's that absolute determination. We can get here without you, thank you. We don't need you. We can build it. We can make it. We can get there without you. We're okay on our own. I love that idea that almost Genesis 1 and 2 starts to reemerge here. What do we read in Genesis 1 and 2? The God who created, created with a word. In technical terms, that's called ex nihilo. Out of nothing, God created something. And now we have technology being used in a way to create something, but it's not quite as good, is it? It's not quite as good. It's out of something to make something else. But it's still the idea that we can be the creative ones. And these actions are at the heart, they are at the absolute heart of Genesis 1 to 11. They are the fundamental building blocks of the human condition, which says that it's played out throughout the rest of the Bible. We can be independent of you, God. We can be our own people. We don't need you. We're fine. The supremacy of God is usurped by the supremacy of humanity. That's the story that we see unfolded in Babel. So we're faced with the dominant question that we face today. Are we better with God? Or are we better by ourselves? If that's the root, what's the fruit? The Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building, and the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. Look at what they're doing. Does it sound like a punishment? Does it sound like God in fear and trembling saying, we'd better do something? Do you see the plural there, by the way? Little kind of critical biblical moment there. We see God speaking in kind of conversation with himself. You get the first, these little seeds that are planted through the Bible that says, God is a God of relationship outside of humanity. There is a notion of God which is, as we see unfolded through the rest of the Bible, it's the Trinity, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. But there's another little flavor, isn't there? Genesis chapter 3 and verse 22. God said, the man has now become like one of us. Knowing good and evil, he must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. It's the same kind of idea. God is looking at what man is doing, what humanity is doing, and saying, if they carry on in that trajectory, they're going to be in real trouble. We think that it sounds like God is punishing them by coming down and confusing things. But I think there is something way deeper. And it's something that if we've walked the Christian pathway any length of time, our experience of God, we find true in this. There are times when we stray from the pathway that we should be walking. One of the astounding graces of God is that he does not leave us comfortable in that trajectory. Have you been there? If you haven't been there, you will go there one day. If you have been there, you know exactly what I am saying. Bunyan captured it brilliantly when Christian left the pathway on the narrow pathway to the way of the king, and he saw a beautiful meadow, bypath meadow. It was stony on the pathway, and the meadow was beautiful grass to walk on, and it was only a tiny little hedge between the pathway and the meadow. So I'll walk along the pathway, and what he didn't realize is the hedge got wider and wider and wider and wider and took him away from the pathway until he ended up where? In Doubting Castle. That's where we end up when we stray. That is the beauty of God's mercy on us, is he doesn't leave us comfortable in that position. He didn't leave these people comfortable in the position of building and building and building. He didn't leave them comfortable in the garden where they could eat of the tree of life and gain life in a rancid condition of knowing good and evil in a way that they couldn't cope with. That is the mercy of God, not the justice of God. It feels hard at the time. It feels hard to be in Doubting Castle, but you know how Christian got out is he found the key of promise. And he remembered, it's not how I feel, it's the promises that God has made. And he found that that key opened every door in the castle and allowed him to get back to the pathway. Because that's how God works. The fruit of our rejection and rebellion is he doesn't leave us in a condition of comfort. I want you to pray, as I pray often, in that discomfort, Lord, please don't let me stay comfortable. Please remind me of the promises that you've made that are bigger than the doubts that I've now got. Do you have doubts? I have doubts. I have doubts. The Christian faith is not about growth and growth and growth, where you become more and more assured. In fact, there are times when those doubts become greater the more that you think you understand, and then you realize, oh man, I don't know what to do with that, but I do know that God is greater than my doubts. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth. And they stopped building the city. That's why it's called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. You see the picture? They were building. There was a time that introduces confusion on them, where they couldn't relate anymore. They couldn't talk a common language. They couldn't sing a common song. That was a fairly poignant one there, wasn't it? When we didn't know what these were singing up here and we just carried it. Did you do a bit of the mime? There is a confusion that emerges. There is a moment where they can no longer work in a cohesive way. They have introduced, by their rebellion and by God's mercy and justice, tribalism and racism and confused language. What did they do as a result? What's really noticeable? If you've gone everything that's gone before, you'd have thought God would have come down and smashed the tower, and he didn't. He just confused them and they abandoned the project. That's humanity. When God intervenes, we just abandon things. Just turn our back on it because it's not working. Our identity ends up in our tribes. But here's the thing. What happens when we get that multiple identity? We end up in the continuous millennia game of who's the king of the castle? Who's building the last few bricks on the top? When they were all united, they could be united in that decision. But I'll tell you, what this is saying is, as soon as they became tribal, and as soon as they had replaced God as supreme, which group lays the last bricks? And they couldn't decide. Does that sound like the coffee battle or the wars in the world? Because when we take God from that supreme place and we place ourselves in that supreme place, here's the question. Which version of ourselves takes supremacy? Which version? Your idea, my idea, communism, socialism, capitalism, east, west, north, south. When God goes, we have no anchor. We have no focal point. We have no ultimate authority, because your idea is as good as mine, and my bricks are as good as your bricks, and I want to be at the top instead of you. There is tribalism laid out in the Bible. One of the wonderful things is God's mercy, because the shoots. Firstly, we've already said God doesn't leave them comfortable. But also he sets up Babylon as the rest of the Bible storyline of the opposition to God and what's going to happen. Let's go a huge leap to Revelation chapter 17. This is really mind-blowing. John's getting this picture in front of him, this idea, this kind of visual kind of insight. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls and came and said to him, "Come, I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries." Have you got the picture? Do you know exactly what's going on? I haven't got a clue what that looks like. But what I do know is that what God is saying is that the nations play with the prostitute who is the one that says, "You are more superior to God." Who is it? The name written on her forehead was a mystery. You're not kidding. Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. "I saw the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus." The nations of the world, the tribalism of the different parts of ideas and thoughts that become supreme above God, that the harlot of Babylon kind of fills the world with saying, "We can be more superior to God," and nations come and nations go and nations rise and nations fall throughout the history of the world, and they all believe the same whore's lies. You can be bigger than God. And what happens? Well, if you read Revelation 17 to 19, what you find is that that lie is destroyed. It's crushed. It's broken. Because that lie that infiltrates the whole of human history, which says that in some way every tribe is more superior to the other. The picture's really incredibly powerful. It's this prostitute who spends time with one and says, "Oh, you're wonderful, you're beautiful, you're more superior to anything else," and then goes and spends time with the next one and says, "You're more superior to everyone else." And actually, all of it is trying to be more superior than each other, but fundamentally more superior to God, because the blood that is poured out is the blood of God's people. And so Jesus comes and he crushes that rebellion. He crushes it. He crushes it. Does he crush it by getting to the top of the tower and say, "I'm the supreme one"? Here's the thing that I find mind-blowing in the way that the whore of Babylon and the rebellion against God and the supremacy of every faction and tribe against the supremacy of God is this. He crushes it by being crushed himself. He crushes it by his blood being shed. There's an amazing verse which we're going to close as we sing. And this is the hope of the gospel, entrusting that Jesus and saying, "I believe that Jesus is going to be my hope and my Lord and my King." It's this, Revelation chapter 20, I think, verse 9, 21 maybe. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count. From every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and they were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." Do you see how Babylon, how Babel is reversed? It's reversed. Because they all know what to sing. And in spite of the fact that they are different tribes, nations, languages, people, they are what? They are together again. You see, that's the hope of the gospel. Do you feel the world is broken? We do. Do we desperately desire something more? We do. Who are they singing praise to? The God who is on the throne, and at the same time, the Lamb that is slain. The picture is impossible to truly portray, but it captures both of those, the King and the slain Lamb. John opens his revelation with this. I looked up, I saw, almost as though it is a Lamb slain and walking. That's the beauty. Because we can't win our way to the top. We've got to be in trust and in allegiance and burying ourselves in the one who is being crushed to be victorious.